Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there, you're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and here's what's coming up today. It would be great to understand the working definition of intelligence.
It's the capacity to make choices is the heart of intelligence.
Where does artificial intelligence fit into this discussion?
Now, a lot of how the individual brain works is through having a model of the world, seeing whether the data confirms the model or disconfirms the model, and then updating the model in the light of what it sees. And that essentially is what one whole strand of AI does.
Why don't you think we'll get AI to be capable of doing those things on its own?
At the moment, our brains are just better at seeing in the round, seeing the factors which might be important when an environment changes or when the problem changes.
That was Sir Geoff Mulgan, Professor of Collective Intelligence, Public Policy and Social Innovation at the University College London. Between 1997 and 2004, Sir Geoff had roles in the UK government, including Director of the Government Strategy Unit and Head of Policy in Prime Minister Tony Blair's office. This was the most interesting conversation where we connected together intelligence, collective intelligence, the future of work, education, policy and strategic vision and social innovation. It is fascinating. But also within this, there's some really fantastic career advice for people of all stages of their career from somebody that has seen the way the economy and education and work has changed over the last 25 to 30 years. Fascinating conversation. I hope you love it in the same way that I did. And now I'm going to hand you over to Professor Geoff Mulgan. Professor Mulgan, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
It would be great to start with understanding more about you and your background and your research interests. So if you could share a little bit of that to get us going, that would be a great place to start.
So I've had a slightly odd career structure from an academic point of view. So I began my life working in local government. I then went to get a PhD in telecommunications. So I got immersed in the world of networks, really in the very early era of the internet. And that to some extent has shaped how I've looked at things. I then struggled to get any academic jobs. I applied for lots and didn't get any, so I went into other fields. And as a result, I've worked most of my career mainly in governments and working sort of top-down for quite a few governments around the world, quite a bit bottom-up, creating new organizations, social enterprises, social innovation. And then from the side, trying to make sense of that, writing academic books, and in the last 4 years, being a professor in the engineering department at University College London. So my work has really focused on two sets of things. One is how to understand thought at large scale. How do societies think, or economies think, or the world thinks? And that's what's taken me to fields like collective intelligence, and indeed the one which I've just started working on a lot this year, which is the design of institutions and organizations, and what are the new ways of thinking about that. And the other question, in a way, is the universal one of social science for 200 years, which is to understand change. How does change happen? How does good change happen? Bad change happen? How do we speed up the good and stop the bad in all of its forms? So those are the kind of, I guess, the unifying topics, but then I go off on lots of tangents.
Got it. So what informed your choices? If you think about your career, it's been very diverse, although I understand clearly, as you just explained, covers across a handful of common themes. What's informed the steps that you've taken as you've gone along your journey?
They've been pretty random. I definitely didn't have a plan. So I was quite lucky. My first job in local government, I was given the task of developing a strategy for the creative industries in London. And that was a time when London seemed very much in decline. Unemployment was very high. There was a lot of pessimism about its prospects. And I was just lucky because it turned out those industries became very important generators of jobs and growth. Out of that, I then became part of a network of creative cities around the world, all sharing experiences and ideas about how do you mobilize innovation and creativity as an engine of growth. It happened my job was abolished. Margaret Thatcher abolished my employer, which was the Greater London Council. So I had to go and do something different, which in this case, I went to MIT to learn about technology because I felt that was a gap in my my knowledge. And I was kind of fascinated to understand the world of the digital, the world of networks. This was before the World Wide Web, before people were using it. But I was lucky again. My hunch was right that this was going to become one of the defining sort of features of my lifetime. But it'd be quite wrong to claim there was any real logic or plan to anything I ever did. Things tended to happen serendipitously.
It's amazing how many people answer that question in the way that you just did. So there was no plan. It was serendipitous. And it seemed to work out tremendously well in the end.
I mean, another example, I became an expert on telecommunications, and I was about to go and work for the European Commission in Brussels as a full-time bureaucrat regulating the networks of Europe. By chance, I got a phone call from a backbench MP called Gordon Brown, who said, come and talk to me about it. I talked to him, and then a week later, he said, do you want a job? Because his researcher happened to be leaving. And because I was quite a political person, I'd been an activist very much as a teenager, I decided to give up the secure, highly paid job in Brussels and take on a completely insecure, pitifully paid job with Gordon Brown. But that turned out to be a good decision. I got to know him. I got to know Tony Blair, who he worked very closely with. We did lots of trips around the world together. And that then got me to be part of what was their project, which became then the government in 1997. And I worked in 10 Downing Street for 7 years after that. But if it hadn't been for that phone call randomly in 1990, I probably would have become a Brussels bureaucrat.
It's really encouraging. I have quite a lot of young listeners, people in their kind of late teens, early 20s that listen to this. And I think that there's actually anxiety amongst that group about what they're going to do with their lives. So hearing stories like that really gives people encouragement that actually, if you just do a good job and you focus on something specific, opportunities do come your way and you can take them along. You can take them or not take them, depending on how you feel at the time and whether it fits your purpose and what you're interested in doing. So thank you so much for sharing.
And just on that, I mean, I always say to people, try and make yourself useful. If you're useful to people, you'll probably then get good opportunities. So don't be shy about being useful. And always, if you have a choice, try and work with people you'll learn something from rather than the high pay or the high status. I see lots of people following the money or following the formality and the status. But it's always a question, especially early in your career, be as close as you can to people who really are, you know, driving, smart, intelligent pioneers. You'll get far more out of that long run than being in a job, which appears, very desirable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's now talk about collective intelligence. I have to confess, it's not necessarily a phrase that I'd come across too many times in the past. So it would be great if you could define it for us, and then we'll go into why it's important and what applications are there of it. But can we just start with the definition of collective intelligence?
Well, in a way, the definition is very simple. It is intelligence at large scale. We all know what individual intelligence is inside the brain. The insight of collective intelligence is, in fact, most intelligence isn't very individual. It happens at large scale in systems, whether it's the system of science or the universities or the media. But in a way, this phrase only came into widespread use with the advent of the internet. And a classic example is Wikipedia. So one of my first jobs was selling encyclopedias door to door. And in those days, an encyclopedia was a fat book. You know, a team of people worked on writing it. And with the arrival of the internet, it was possible to create an encyclopedia with a completely different logic, where millions of people could collaborate to write the entries, as with Wikipedia. With careful editing and so on. And since the arrival of the internet, lots and lots of fields have, in a sense, been applying this model of how do you orchestrate intelligence at large scale, either to organize knowledge or information or to solve problems. And in part, the collective intelligence field is saying this has to be a crucial part of our future, that we get much better at doing this. So this matters a lot for governments. If you're trying to solve a problem, you know, one extreme, you create a tiny little committee of maybe ministers or civil servants in Whitehall or Paris or Washington to solve the problem. And at the other extreme, you try and find ways of tapping into the insights, the experience of millions of people who might have experienced the problem. And those are quite different ways of thinking about how the world should work. But of course, seen through this lens as well, you look back at history in a different way. And in the last 5 years, there have been some fantastic books really looking at human history as essentially a history of collective intelligence. How were vast libraries organized or networks of scholars? How was memory organized? How was creativity organized? And one example which sort of surprised me, I'd always thought, say, Wikipedia was one of the first very widely seen examples of collective intelligence. I discovered that the Oxford English Dictionary was actually also an example in the mid-19th century when the guy who started it realized this was a job beyond the capacities of any individual, even a small team, to map the entire English language, all of its uses over history. And he mobilized an army of thousands of people to gather examples from medieval literature or Elizabethan literature on little pieces of paper and then orchestrated into what became the Oxford English Dictionary. So there's a long, long history of collective intelligence. And I think it's very important for us to understand, you know, 95% probably of our own intelligence is really collective. We are vehicles for, you know, ideas which come from others or generated from others. There's very little which is purely original from anyone. And this is, I think, quite humbling, but also liberating to realize that. So this is an emerging discipline. Collective intelligence is looking at how intelligence is organized at almost every level, from the physics to the cellular level, to ants and bees. Bees are a very well-known example of collective intelligence. Their colonies are really smart, even though the individual bee is pretty dumb. There's lots of work on birds and how, again, they organize these incredible migrations across the world or incredible complex tasks, but again, with very, very small brains, and fish as well, all the way up to human societies and organizations. And to me, the really fascinating examples are ones like on climate change. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, is a really good example of collective intelligence founded in the late 80s. To orchestrate the world's scientific knowledge, to make sense of climate change, to do forecasts and so on, but involving thousands and thousands of scientists synthesizing, distilling their insights rather than, as I say, a committee of five or one or two. And for me, this is with the future of our species has to be about becoming much smarter at using our collective intelligence for the things which really matter.
Okay, that's really clear. Thank you. I love the bees and the ants examples as well. I hadn't really connected the dots at all, actually, when I was preparing for the discussion. This is going to sound like a probably very basic question, but it would be helpful to understand how we define intelligence, actually. So what is intelligence? I think some of the examples you gave, like the dictionary or Wikipedia, our intelligence, I would assume, because it's a record of things that we know. But it would be great to understand the working definition of intelligence, and then we can build on that to cover some more examples if we could.
So there's a vast literature trying to define intelligence. I go back to the etymology of the word. The word comes from the Latin, and it's sort of two words brought together, which are essentially about choosing. It's the capacity to make choices is the heart of intelligence. So in a way, in the Latin roots of the word is a sense of the brain in the world making choices between different routes. In the book I wrote on collective intelligence, Big Mind, I then try and break that down into a series of really functions or capacities, which you can have hopefully you have in your own brain, but also apply to collectives. So one is, as you said, memory. How do you organize your knowledge of what happened in the past, which you could do in books and libraries and experts and so on. There's observation. How do you make sure you are seeing the things which really matter? We do it with our eyes and our ears. Increasingly, we do it with data or satellites or monitors of all kinds. How do you create new ideas? Again, that's a quite different function, the ability to problem solve creatively, to combine existing elements in novel ways. There's our motor coordination. That is part of our intelligence, is how our bodies connect to our brains. And again, that applies to a society too. How does it, you know, coordinate its flows of matter or energy, its vehicles, its planes, and so on? And there's a whole series of other layers, including judgment and wisdom, which I write quite a bit about, which are also part of what we count as intelligence. And it takes you to lots of interesting things, for example, both at an individual level, but also in groups. You can get an unbalance. So you can be so focused on memory and the past, never forget, you know, that you don't cope with the present. Or you see some organizations so overwhelmed with data, immediate short-term data, they lose sight of the future and the long term. So both, as I say, in our own individual lives, but also at a larger scale, it's vital both to organize each of these functions well, to make sure you are observing the things that matter, you are remembering what matters, you are creative, you exercise judgment and wisdom, but also to keep these in a reasonable balance with each other. Otherwise, pathologies follow.
Where does artificial intelligence fit into this discussion?
So AI, which has been around with us for 70 years or so, has been incredibly powerful in some of these capabilities of intelligence. So AI is very, very useful for making sense of observations, for spotting patterns in the data. It can be very good for prediction. And most of the recent AI, which is based on machine learning and then deep learning, are essentially prediction tools. And our brains are constantly predicting. A lot of how the individual brain works is through having a model of the world, seeing whether the data confirms the model or disconfirms the model, and then updating the model in the light of what it sees. And that essentially is what, say, one whole strand of AI does. It's quite useful for the memory. One of the things I work on at the moment is the use of generative AI tools for accessing evidence. Let's say you are a policymaker trying to work out how to cut carbon emissions in a particular industry. We can use not ChatGPT, but other versions of large language models to really quickly gather huge amounts of data and synthesize them and make sense of them. So AI is very much part of the collective memory. Where it's much less useful so far is on things like creativity and judgment and wisdom. There are some emerging AIs which can be quite useful in prompting creative options. So I think it's wrong to say AI can never be creative, but it's mainly creative combined with humans. And so far, computing hasn't been great on wisdom at all. Indeed, often quite the opposite. It's what I said earlier about unbalanced intelligence. Always the concern with AI is it would be brilliant, but in a very, very narrowly focused way, unable to see the bigger picture, very weak on peripheral vision, very weak on things like ethics and taking account of different issues. And I've been arguing for many years without much success to the AI scientists. They put a little bit of effort into thinking about the wisdom of intelligence, not just the processing power, the predictive capacity. But that's not a message which has got through in a way, because AI has been so successful in that sort of narrower definition of what intelligence is. But for me, the test is we all can kind of spot a person or an institution or a nation which is or is not intelligent. And usually that's some kind of wisdom, that's some ability to understand things in a round, not to be trapped in a very linear logic.
See, what's interesting, and I'd like to build on this conversation if we could, what's interesting is that when, whether it's OpenAI or one of their competitors launch a new model, they quite often demonstrate the use of that model by asking it to take exams, the law exams or GMAT, whichever ones they want to do, which in kind of conventional way, we see as measures of intelligence. their scores, so to speak, and they can say, well, this AI can do this exam in the top 2% of any human, or can beat any human in 2 minutes rather than doing it in 2 hours. So why is it that you, is that just too narrow a definition of intelligence, or why is it that you think that the AI tools that we have aren't already more intelligent in some ways than humans are, given that the measures of how they kind of announce, when they announce the new models?
Yeah, I mean, that they do fantastically well in certain kinds of exam, and if they're not already doing so, will fairly quickly outperform all but a tiny minority of humans. But ask your question. If you ask employers, I was last week in a big session on the civil service, the UK civil service and its recruitment and its training plans. No big employer employs people just by their exam results. You'd be really stupid to do that as an employer, because those exams tell you something about individual intelligence, but they don't really tell you that much about how an individual will perform in a team or in an organization. So usually big organizations try and test people in multiple ways. Yes, there's a sort of raw intelligence. Can you, you know, pass a law exam or a maths exam? But they also see problem-solving ability. They throw at you something new, which you won't have seen before, and see how you think about it in the round. And they may try and look at how well you collaborate with other people, because that's a huge amount of the reality of the workplace. So again, I think AI, you know, does very, very well in certain kinds of intelligence tasks, not so well in others. And this gets back to the collective intelligence point. One of the really interesting things happening in many fields is thinking about hybrids. What is the combination of human and machine intelligence which is most effective? Now, we saw this even 5 or 6 years ago in the big platforms like Facebook. So Facebook had this huge problem of hate speech, all these, you know, these terrible things being spread on Facebook. Their algorithms on their own couldn't identify these or respond quickly enough. So they've had to employ tens of thousands of people to work as well with the algorithms responding in real time to different kinds of hate speech. You see the same in governments, where they're using AI maybe to make decisions on pensions or welfare or criminal justice. If you only rely on the algorithms, you get horrible errors all the time. So they're trying to work on what is the combination of the algorithm, but also human collective intelligence, which can help you quickly make more rounded, smarter judgments. And almost everything which really matters, this is actually the direction of travel. It's not talked about so much by the AI world because it slightly undermines their story. And if you look behind AI, again, one of the sort of dirty little secrets of AI in reality is lots of people adjusting the algorithms sort of in the back room, as it were, because nearly always their first versions don't quite work. So they're much more human, I think, than is often assumed in order to be effective in the real world. There's a lot of hype about AI, of course, and a lot of misleading stuff. I'm generally an enthusiast, I should say. But in most real life fields where there's high stakes, it will nearly always be some combination of algorithms and collective human intelligence which helps us get the best out of the smart machines.
Why do you think we won't get there? Why don't you think we'll get AI to be capable of doing those things on its own?
It may be, but it's just not at the moment. And it's partly because of the nature of you know, Bayesian logic and binary logic. At the moment, our brains, and certainly our brains collectively, are just better at seeing in the round, seeing, say, as peripheral vision, seeing the factors which might be important when an environment changes or when the problem changes. If you're in a very stable environment with fairly predictable elements, AI can do pretty well. And we've seen this with driverless cars. You know, why are driverless cars not on all our streets? 10 years ago, many people thought by 2024, they would be basically mature, they would have arrived. And part of the reason is they are pretty good at functioning in predictable environments. And this is what China's trying to do with driverless cars, is make the environments predictable. But in the complex reality of, you know, a city in Britain or North America, just too many things go wrong. And that's why there's too many unpredictable events, which you can't pre-program. And we as individual drivers are not great. I mean, in many ways, an AI driver is a lot better than a human driver. But we can roughly tell the difference between, you know, an old lady crossing the road, a bit of rubbish in the road, rainfall, snowfall, all these different things, which actually the algorithms still struggle with. They may get there, you know, but for now, a lot of the predictions have turned out to be wrong. Driverless cars is one example. Radiology is another one where many of the AI gurus about 10 years ago predicted all radiologists would have gone by now. In fact, their numbers are growing in most countries. So it's important to apply intelligence to AI because often, ironically, it becomes a field of rather foolish predictions and comments, which is perhaps always the case with fashions. They attract a lot of silliness as well as reality.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting that you talk about it in that way. So you mentioned earlier wisdom. And I hadn't really thought about the difference between wisdom and intelligence, and that it's quite difficult to get an artificial version of wisdom. Why is this the peripheral vision that you've been talking about? Why is it difficult to recreate wisdom that humans have?
So I wrote a paper in the pandemic, actually, originally for the Finnish government, asked me to do one on what was wisdom in governments. And that got me really fascinated in this question. And there is a huge global literature on wisdom going back thousands of years, which is absolutely fascinating. And to try and distill it to its essence, a lot of what we think of as wisdom, you can think of it as a kind of incorporation of layers of classic intelligence, of, you know, knowledge and logic and so on. But often what we most recognize by wisdom is the ability to understand a context of a place or a time or of people. And it's the ability, in a way, to relate the generic knowledge to the specificity of a context is what we most admire as wisdom. And that's precisely what AI struggles with, because it's very good at standardized, you know, predictive knowledge, but not very good at understanding nuance of context. We also nearly always think of wisdom as incorporating ethics, an ability to make judgments about right and wrong, as well as, you know, false and accurate. And often we see as wisdom the ability to take a really long view, you know, to see things in the span of generations. Now, in theory, maybe you could develop computational reasoning, which would do all of those things. And at one point, Japan did actually have a wisdom computing program. It didn't actually deliver very much, but it was at least asking a good question. The AI world of the US and the UK, and more recently China, has done almost literally nothing in this space. But I think it needs to try and, in a sense, engage with the lessons of wisdom to think, what would an AI look like? And in my paper, I do make various suggestions about how you might even build it into something like the design of a car or a search engine. What would be a wisdom-enhancing car or search engine? And often it's one which is actually teaching the user as it goes. Or in the case of a search engine, it might be asking you questions as well as giving you answers. And I think this, anyway, is probably where search engines should go, rather than just immediately giving you an answer to your question. Helping you through Socratic reasoning, the questioning, better understand what you really want, what you're really trying to get to. And this is, I think, a plausible route for technology to take. It's not really a route anyone is taking quite now, but I think that would help us avoid what I see as one of the perils of the next 10 or 20 years, is phenomenally smart machines, which are phenomenally foolish. And this is a problem which has been written about for 60 or 70 years. Martin Luther King commented on it, Einstein, everyone, this risk of humans being super clever and totally unwise. And I'm afraid it happens all the time. And AI is a particularly extreme current example, where we have, for example, a social media system, much of which is based on AI algorithms, which with no one really intended it to spread lies, misinformation, destruction of democracy. But that's what it's done because it was very smart and very foolish at the same time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's move this on to the conversation around education and work. So collective intelligence, artificial intelligence, wisdom and potential of how you can add wisdom into your algorithms or your systems and processes in the future is just a fascinating discussion. I think there's a lot of anxiety, and it is driven by artificial intelligence. And this isn't a conversation about artificial intelligence. It's a conversation about intelligence in my mind. But you can't kind of ignore that narrative that's going on at the moment. So there's a lot of anxiety at the moment, I think, around what people might be doing in the future, what work they might be doing, and what they might need to know, what skills they might need to have in order to be successful in the future marketplace. And the underlying concern is, I don't know whether I'm learning or doing the right things that's going to make me productive, help me be productive in the future. What's your perspective on this kind of discussion that's currently happening, driven by AI, but clearly linked to all of the other things that we've talked about in this conversation so far?
So this is a field that I've been pretty heavily involved in for about 10 years, mainly prompted by about 10 years ago, doing quite a few sessions in secondary schools with teenagers on future jobs. You know, what will your job be in 10, 20 years' time? How do you know what skills to prioritize, what subjects to choose? And in my last job at Nesta, prompted by that, I funded various prototypes of what I thought would be needed for any society to make sense of these challenges. So one was a data task of mapping every single job, vacancy, pay levels, skills demands, and what was actually happening in the present. That didn't really exist then, but we did some very good versions of that. Secondly, was making predictions of which jobs would be likely to grow or shrink. And we did a big study in the US and UK on that, using actually AI and as well as human experts to try and make some, you know, reasonably well-informed forecasts. And then the crucial third element was then to turn that into navigation tools, which would be usable if you were a 15-year-old, or let's say you're 55-year-old, you've just lost your job in, I don't know, shipbuilding or steel. What would help you navigate? So we did prototypes of all of those, some very large scale. And I tried then persuading the British government to do it properly. But one of the, and we held gatherings of all the departments, but this was one of many things where the political chaos of Britain in the last 5 or 6 years, with endless turnover of ministers and prime ministers, meant this sort of thing didn't happen. More recently, this year, I've been working with other countries on variants of this. Australia is doing it quite well, Singapore, Canada. And a prime example is Bangladesh, a country of 180 million people, which faces huge potential threats from automation. Many of their jobs are in clothing and furniture and leather, and in principle could be automated out of existence very fast. So I've been working with them since actually just before the pandemic on exactly what I described, this sort of data gathering, prediction, and then navigation tools, which is now a national online platform in Bangladesh. And we're spreading that to about another 10 other countries are adopting this model in the developing world. And so it's a field which is moving quite fast, but it's still a long way, I think, from what could be done. And if you are, and I still go quite regularly to secondary schools in England and do sessions, and I find most of the 15, 16, 17-year-olds have not really been given any very good guidance on the jobs of the future. There aren't the, you know, really good online tools to help them self-assess, to map out their own pathways. Our government, despite in some ways having fantastic statistics and data, has been hopeless, absolutely hopeless on this. On this topic. And that's why I think people feel in some ways probably more anxious than they should do. Because one of the things which comes out when you do these analyses is they show that probably, as in the past, there will be lots of new jobs as well as jobs being destroyed. Many of those new jobs may be quite good. When we did our big forecast for the US and the UK, we showed the likelihood of quite big growth in fields like health and education, sports, therapy, flower selling, all sorts of odd ones you wouldn't think of actually turned out to be likely to grow quite a lot. It's crucial, though, that any young person is not just getting some technical skills, but also skills of communication and problem solving and collaboration and creativity. These more generic skills probably are becoming more important in the labor market as it changes. And I'm quite critical of schools policy, certainly in the UK, that it hasn't really adapted to this. It's mainly training kids for the jobs of 10 or 20 years ago, not the jobs of the future. And digital was the really striking thing. So the government was funding quite a lot of courses in digital skills. It thought that was the way to be ready for the future. But we showed, and this is maybe counterintuitive, that many digital jobs are likely to shrink really fast because of digital technology. And most of the things government was training people for were precisely the digital jobs which were likely to shrink fastest. And this was where the lack of intelligence, the lack of proper use of data, led to pretty dumb policies. And this is why a more systemic approach to future jobs, skills, navigation tools, I think is so vital to avoid a lot of wasted money, but also to help people navigate what, you know, is quite a scary few decades ahead.
It is. And, you know, it's really interesting. My daughter is doing her A-level exams this summer, and she's doing two of the A-levels that she is doing, I took 30 years ago. And one was maths and one was business studies. And I picked up the past papers that she was working on a couple of weeks ago, and they're basically the same. This is the thing that I found unbelievable, that they are basically the same course as I learned 30 years ago. Why is that? Why is that? You hear a lot of, I mean, my peers, my friends that have children, talk a lot about the schools not equipping people to be useful in the workforce. That's a general undertone of what conversations I would have on a semi-regular basis. And you've touched on that a little bit in your last answer. Why is it that schools and education are not being reformed in the way that they need to be?
Well, I actually think there's the blame is shared quite widely, and it's different in different countries, but education systems have a remarkable degree of inertia. I'm doing a project, one of the PhD students I supervise who worked in the education ministry in Chile is looking at what makes an education system collectively intelligent. And it's not so difficult to describe what an education system would look like, which really was collectively intelligent, where teachers were using data, using evidence, trying out maybe new ways of teaching maths or helping kids with special needs, and then sharing that knowledge very quickly across the system. Or when something like ChatGPT comes along, systematically seeing, is this useful in the classroom? How do we use it? What works? What doesn't? And sharing it. But no education system on the planet is close to that. The teachers often learn stuff, you know, 20, 30 years ago. They mainly rely on just their local peers. There aren't good systems of learning and knowledge. And in some countries, like in England, I actually think we've been very unlucky in schools ministers. We had a schools minister for 10 years, a guy called Nick Gibb, who was quite effective in a very narrow exam-oriented version of schooling, but completely uninterested in the question you mentioned. The fact that employers again and again said you're throwing out kids who aren't actually ready for the realities of life and work was not of interest to him. And so our system sort of shut its eyes off from that kind of peripheral vision, despite lots of commissions and, you know, inputs from teachers and from employers and others. The system became, I think, more and more rigid. And it measured its own successes in terms of mainly exam results and patted itself on the back that it was doing really well. Now, that's a much bigger issue about what schooling should be, but I hope no one would disagree that in principle, an education system should be capable of learning, should really invest heavily in its own ability to generate new knowledge, insights, to test ideas, to continually improve its own operations. And later this year, we'll be putting out, I hope with the OECD, really recommendations on how do you make a school system more like a true collective intelligence, where it's doing all the things we described earlier. You know, it's observing the things that matter, not just the exam results. It has a memory, you know, it can learn from what's worked in the past or not worked. It's creative. It uses judgment and wisdom rather than a very narrow intelligence, so that, and this will become absolutely critical as new AI tools come into the education system, that there is a capability of assessing them, evaluating them, adapting them to the realities of a primary school, a secondary school, a university, and so on. But at the moment, we've got no one in the system who quite owns that as a problem. We have a continual cycle of ministers who often don't last for more than a few months. And when they do last, often not is not very healthy. And we have a system very focused on measurement and audit and inspection, and not very focused, ironically, on learning.
Are there any countries in the world that are getting this right?
Well, I worked for many years a lot with the Finnish education system, which used to be often ranked the world best. It's sort of slipped two or three places. That was a very different approach, where they really focused on teacher quality and giving teachers space to learn. For example, once a month, study circles where the teachers would come together and discuss new knowledge and new approaches, etc. And it was much more about supporting them to do good work and also running experiments. In a very different way, Singapore has been pretty good at both a very, very effective teaching of things like maths, but also has invested heavily in the learning of the system, the ability to make sense of new technology tools and how those could be used. So there are some good examples, but I think in most countries, education systems are remarkably resistant to new knowledge and new ideas. The inertia of the system is the most striking feature. And my colleague Martin from Chile has gathered it's a huge literature on systems inertia in education and its inability to learn. So we have a bit of a problem. And I mean, in relation to jobs, just one final thing. I mean, of course, almost by definition, a teacher of 40, 50, 50, you know, 60 years old who might be absolutely brilliant at teaching physics or maths or business studies probably hasn't had much interaction with the reality of jobs in those fields for a very long time. They just don't know what it's like to be inside, I don't know, a big pharma company or an AI company or even a hospital. And so it's not surprising there's a bit of a mismatch between the way the school system thinks and the reality of the world into which their pupils will be going.
So how do you foster innovation in these types of public services? How do we make that happen?
Well, I've spent a lot of my work, my career, trying to both theorize that, but also put it into practice, working with many governments on innovation funds, innovation labs, methods of doing experiments and learning. And in essence, I mean, this is quite a complicated question, but in essence, I guess most of what I've always argued for is just to take the best from the world of science. And I sometimes say that in the 19th century, science mainly meant many men, you know, working like in a shed in their garden, doing experiments with, you know, chemicals or whatever. And then in the first half of the 20th century, it became massively organized and institutionalized. Large R&D departments, governments spent huge amounts of money on science, universities were built up. And the method of doing systematic experiment, you know, gathering the data, synthesizing the knowledge, teaching it became institutionalized. And much of our world is a result of the institutionalization of science, of chemistry and biology and physics and so on, in all the machines we're using at this very moment. In relation to public services and the social field, it's still essentially the 19th century level. It's the occasional little with one-off experiment, random projects. Most governments have no budget for their own innovation. if there are teams working on it, they come and go. They're not stable and secure. They don't have very good methods of measurement or assessment. There aren't roles, you know, in charge of it in the way there is in science. So a starting point is simply to adopt what's worked so well in science and apply it to things like teaching in the classroom, or for that matter, running welfare programs or big projects, all the things governments do. And there's quite an extensive toolkit now of ways of operationalizing that. And some governments are doing it fairly well, not brilliantly. We saw some fantastic innovation during the pandemic, when all over the world, governments within a few weeks had put all their education online, often created cash payments to every family, not to mention then rolling out vaccination programs. So, you know, governments can be phenomenally innovative, but they just need to do it, in my view, much more systematically in the way that we do scientific R&D.
Do you see a path to that happening, or is there resistance to adopting that type of approach?
It's slowly moving in that direction, and partly influenced by the digital world and the recognition that so much of the future of government will involve much more use of data, of platforms, of AI, all these sort of things. The governments which have moved fastest are often not the ones which were the leaders perhaps a generation ago. So there are small countries like Estonia in Europe is probably the lead. Ukraine, under pressure of war, has completely transformed its use of digital tech in government. And India, which has run the biggest innovation project of the last 10 years, which is the Aadhaar project of biometric identity, which they've now provided for nearly 1.3 billion people, that allowed a complete reorganization, not just of government services, but also of finance services, banking. And they're now exporting that to dozens of countries because it's actually a very effective model. 20, 30 years ago, people wouldn't have expected India to have leapfrogged ahead of the US and France and the UK in digital government, but that's pretty much what has happened.
It's interesting. So if you think about so we're talking to a parent of a young teenager, or a, you know, a teenager or an early 20s person that's listening to here now. They're hearing two things. So firstly, there's lots of things going on in the world that's creating their own anxiety about their future. And we've also got, on the other hand, public services not really keeping up. So right at the beginning of the conversation, you gave the advice of becoming useful. Be useful. So what does useful mean in today's world? If you're a young person, what do they need to do to become useful?
So my sort of summary view, and I guess what I tried doing a little bit, was I think it's good to have some field you really know deeply. And it could be chemistry or physics or, you know, mechanical engineering or health, or but try and have some core which you really care about, where, you know, you really know stuff. That's kind of the downward, the vertical of a T, but then make sure you also cultivate the top of the T, which is wide reading, curiosity, learn about different things. Ideally volunteer, get involved in projects where you're working with others, solving problems, dealing with things. And that combination is how you can be most useful. So if you come to a topic, you're bringing some knowledge the others don't have because you've studied it. And ideally you've studied not just the books, the articles, but also the YouTube videos, and maybe seen the stuff which so many universities now put online. This is an incredible era to be alive in terms of what's available for learning. But then have that wider set of skills which allow you then to put that into practice in a real context, which you can only really get from experience. You can't get that from reading books. You get that from doing things with others. It can be in sports, it can be in music, or it can be in, you know, in volunteering in your local food bank or whatever it may be. But it's that combination, I think, is key to making people useful.
Do you think it matters what the core is?
We live in a very, very complex society. So we need lots and lots of specialists in lots and lots of different things. And it could be making furniture or ceramics, or it could be almost anything. In a way, although there's been some disparaging of experts in recent years, a complex, sophisticated society is entirely built on experts, people who have really deep knowledge of stuff. And if you're totally generalist and thinly spread over anything, you won't be that useful. So I would always encourage people cultivate at least one, maybe more, real depth of knowledge where you know much more than most of the people around you. And that's crucial to being useful in the world.
Absolutely. And actually, we directed that answer at younger people, but that's relevant if you're 50 or 60 years old, as well as it if you're 18 or 19 years old.
And keep it up, because the knowledge changes. I mean, even in, making furniture or ceramics or, whatever, the knowledge now is different from 30 or 40 years ago. So that constant updating, curiosity, immersion in different fields is really useful. And I'd always encourage people to spend quite a bit of time in the arts as well, because I think that's what also keeps us, our brains, alive. This weekend, I happened to go to an extraordinary ballet performance, which was turned a committee meeting into a ballet, which sounds completely implausible. It was the most phenomenal ballet I've seen in a long time. A series of art shows using AI and art, Rafik Anadol, Bertinsky's photographs of climate and waste and industrial production, an extraordinary film about a book about racism in America, the film called Origin, about the book Cast. We live in a time of extraordinary resources at our fingertips in culture, and these feed your brain. So even if you are very much a STEM person or working in engineering and science, do put some time into engaging with the frontiers of contemporary arts, because that's really, really useful to you long term.
Absolutely. This has been a fascinating conversation. Thanks for taking the time to do it today. Do you have any final message or key points that you'd like the listeners to take away from our discussion today?
The final one I'd say, which we haven't touched on, is one of the things I've worked on a bit in recent years, is imagination. And this was prompted by realizing a lot of young people especially are really pessimistic about the future, sometimes for very good reasons. They look at climate change, they look at AI and robots, and so on. And they can't always picture how could their society be better a generation or two into the future. We have life expectancies now for many young people of 90, 100, maybe 110. So it's really important to take a long view. And I think we've overshot in this pessimism. I actually think there are good reasons for being more optimistic about our possibility in the long run to reshape democracy or welfare or our cities to be fantastic places for us. So I'd encourage you not to become slaves of, as it were, lazy pessimism, which assumes the world is completely messed up, everything's a disaster. Some things are, but other things aren't. And, you almost owe it to yourself and your generation to cultivate your positive imagination and think about what can be done now that would make the world 30, 40, 50 years into the future one you would really want to live in.
Fantastic advice. Professor Mogan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow us on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.